Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who talks about President Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima and the prominent list of scholars and activists who are asking him to take concrete steps towards nuclear disarmament. Becky Meyer, an anti-frack gas pipeline activist, who considers some of the challenges of not-in-my-backyard attitudes among some fellow property owners who aren't engaged in the larger issue of climate change. And author and activist Tariq Ali, who discusses the growing worldwide movement resisting economic inequality and austerity. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Waves of protests have overtaken Warsaw, Poland, in opposition to the right-wing Law and Justice Party and its nationalist agenda, which took full control of the government last fall. The conservative government, which is seeking a total ban on abortion, received a rebuke from the European Union for exacerbating conflicts with Poland's judiciary and the media. Poland is seen as one of Europe's economic success stories since its entry into the EU, but many conservative rural communities were left behind over the last generation, and they harbor strong resentment against Europe's liberal culture. These rural voters gave the Law and Justice Party Poland's first majority government since the fall of the Berlin Wall. This spring, liberal activists in Poland rose up against the ultra-conservative party and its authoritarian tendencies, which included actions taken to weaken the constitutional court. Three former Polish presidents, including Solidarity leader Lech Walesa, condemned the right-wing government and called on Polish citizens to defend democracy. The Huffington Post reports protests have broken out in Gambia, one of the most repressive nations in Africa. President Yahya Jammeh took power in a 1994 coup in the West African nation of 2 million people. In recent years, thousands of refugees have fled the country to escape atrocities, including the murder of gay men. In mid-April, sustained demonstrations broke out against President Jammeh, who has the loyalty of Gambia's brutal security services and paramilitary groups. Protesters demanded major electoral reforms in advance of upcoming elections scheduled for December. In Gambia's last election in 2011, the European Union and the Economic Community of West African States refused to send election observers due to the brutal repression of opposition party activists. After the first protest in April, protests were attacked by police, and leading opposition leader Solo Sandeng is believed to have died while in police custody. While the crackdown may have been intended to intimidate activists, Sandeng's death and the imprisonment of top opposition leaders caused outrage, and the protest resumed. The European Union and the United States condemned the attacks on protesters, and United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed his dismay. Political gridlock on Capitol Hill has taken its toll on adequately maintaining the nation's roads and bridges. Recent attempts to raise the gas tax to boost funding for the Highway Trust Fund have stalled as the backlog of unfunded transit projects has piled up. By 2025, the price of maintaining and updating the country's infrastructure will total $3.3 trillion, but planned investments are only $1.8 trillion, leaving a $1.4 trillion gap. That shortfall is projected to grow to $5.1 trillion by the year 2040 if spending continues on the current trajectory, according to the latest report from the American Society of Civil Engineers. In launching the post-recession stimulus program in 2009, President Obama boasted of shovel-ready transit projects. Yet in the end, only $105 billion of the stimulus package was spent on infrastructure. Congress last boosted the gas tax in 1993, and the Highway Trust Fund may go broke in a decade without a new infusion of revenue. Last year, Congress passed a 5-year transportation bill without increasing the gas tax and relied instead on accounting gimmicks, such as shifting funds from the Federal Reserve. Yet with an increasing number of roads and bridges in disrepair, a dozen states, including conservative enclaves like Georgia, Idaho, and Nebraska, have raised gas taxes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Barack Obama will be the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Japanese city of Hiroshima, the site of the world's first atomic bomb attack during the waning days of World War II. Mr. Obama, who will be in Japan for a G7 summit meeting, will tour Hiroshima on May 27th, the city where an estimated 140,000 civilians died after the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on August 6, 1945. A second American nuclear bomb targeted the Japanese city of Nagasaki on August 9th. Japan surrendered less than 1 week later. The president says that his visit to Hiroshima will emphasize the friendly ties between former enemies, but that he would not apologize for America's use of nuclear weapons against Japan's civilian population. While a majority of Americans see the bombings as justified to end the war and save lives, a view disputed by many historians, most Japanese believe that the use of atomic weapons wasn't justified, according to public opinion polls. In response to the president's announced visit to Hiroshima, more than 70 prominent scholars and activists, including Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Oliver Stone, signed a letter calling on Mr. Obama to take concrete steps towards nuclear disarmament during his remaining months in office. Some of those signatories opposed the president's support for spending $1 trillion over the next 3 decades to build a new generation of U.S. nuclear weapons and delivery systems. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, communications and political director with the group Peace Action, who talks about the significance of President Obama's visit to Hiroshima and the letter calling on him to take action to move the world closer to the abolition of nuclear weapons.
This is the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima. It is a big deal to the Japanese. If you look at any Japanese media, they are going crazy over there about this visit. They celebrate this and commemorate this very intently with tens of thousands of people attending the commemorations in August. And, you know, they have expectations of what this might mean to them. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what Obama's remarks are and what he does when he's there.
Paul, your group, along with more than 70 scholars and activists, signed a letter in support of the president's trip to Hiroshima, but called upon him to use his remaining months in office to take substantive action to move the world closer to the abolition of nuclear weapons. Maybe you could talk about this letter and specifically what you and the other signatories want the president to move towards while he's still got some time in office.
Sure. I mean, the president deserves praise, not only this trip, but he also put together and pushed forward through the Senate the passing of a New START treaty that reduced the number of strategic warheads that the U.S. and Russia both have now to like 1,550. He also pushed through last year the Iran agreement that has put Iran from having the capabilities of possibly putting together a crude nuclear weapon in 3 months to now over a year, plus having verification and monitoring of their nuclear program, which will keep them having a nuclear weapon in the immediate future. And he's also held a number of nuclear security summits that have done things to close the loop on loose nukes and nuclear materials to make sure it doesn't get in the wrong hands. That's all great. On the other hand, the administration has been putting forth a plan to upgrade all of our nuclear warheads and all the delivery systems, bombers, submarines, and missiles, to the tune of about $1 trillion over the next 30 years. So in one hand, he's saying, let's get rid of these things and have a world free of nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, we're funding, upgrading, and building them into the indefinite future. So certainly a couple of steps he could take would be, one, let's reduce that funding. He can start with a simple thing, which is there's funding to try to build something called a new nuclear cruise missile. It's called the long-range standoff missile. That could be cut in some sort of a way. I mentioned our strategic warheads. Many in the military say we can get down to 200, 300, 400 strategic warheads and still have a deterrent. So he could cut and put a challenge to Russia to also cut, but he could go easily from 1,500 to 1,000, which the Pentagon has already approved, or even deeper cuts there. That's something he can do. And a lot of people don't know that we still have our warheads set on something called hair trigger alert, which means if we think that we're being attacked, the president could actually launch a nuclear weapon within about 10 minutes. That puts a lot of pressure on someone. Like this hair trigger alert's also in Russia. Mistakes have happened where we've actually thought that we're being attacked here in the U.S. at one point, where the National Security Advisor Brezhnev was about to call the president to say we were being attacked and found out that it was actually a false alarm. So there's several of those things have happened. So he could actually take nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. And lastly, we also have several thousand warheads called reserve in case something goes wrong with the warhead, you can replace it. We really don't need several thousand to replace 1,500. We can start dismantling. So a number of things he could do to push us towards going to zero, and then also, you know, reaching out to Russia, even in this hard time of our relations between us and Russia. This is something that Russia might even agree to and actually could help relations with us and Russia, is to reach out for some sort of another agreement. So there's a long list of things he can do. We hope that he at least talks about one or two of these in the coming weeks and actually takes action before he leaves office.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Communications and Political Director with Peace Action. Learn more about the scholars and activists calling on President Obama to move toward nuclear disarmament by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Across the United States, proposed frack gas pipelines are being canceled, even as many more such projects are applying for permits through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which must first grant a certificate of public convenience and necessity to enable these projects to be built. Those pipeline projects that have been canceled or suspended and not likely to be revived include the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline that would have traversed the states of Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, the Constitution Pipeline in Pennsylvania and New York, and the Pacific Connector Pipeline in Oregon. Reasons for the cancellations vary, from a lack of customers to buy the gas to the failure of companies to win permits through state health regulators. In every case, however, opposition by local residents and homeowners has been critical to these victories. In these fights, some opponents have always emphasized the need to move away from all fossil fuels in order to curb climate change. But much of the passion and the big numbers turning out for anti-pipeline hearings have come from homeowners who didn't want the pipelines crossing over or near their property. Many, in fact, were less concerned with the issue of climate change. This familiar attitude is often referred to as NIMBY, or not in my backyard. Now that several of these pipeline projects are no longer a threat, some activists who worked on these campaigns are coming together in an effort to convince their neighbors to join them in taking on the larger issue of climate change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Becky Meyer, a New York State resident who was active in the campaign opposing the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline. Here she explains some of the challenges of NIMBY attitudes and how she plans to appeal for a united front to address climate change.
All along, we wanted to be doing two things simultaneously, fighting the gas pipeline and creating the alternative. The fight part took all of our time and energy. So now we have 1,500 people on our mailing list. We've, you know, had up to 340 people come to our meetings. We have a lot of people who have been educated about the problems with fossil fuels and the concerns about climate change. And initially, the impetus for many of these people was NIMBY. But we really all along really talked about the problems with fracking, about the environment, about the communities where they were fracking in the Marcellus shale fields, that this was bigger than just saving their backyard. And we really developed a group of passionate fighters. And so we want to garner that energy to continue and beyond the NIMBYism.
You mentioned doing a lot of education and networking going forward. Is there anything else you hope to do?
I'm hoping to, and there was a lot of enthusiasm in this as I've talked to people about it, to organize a renewable fair. Because so many of us, you know, it's on our list to switch our electric bill to some renewable source or to insulate the house or to get free energy audits from the electric company. But I know I didn't do it until this whole thing came up. So we want to have a big energy fair where we bring all the local resources that people can use to change their use of fossil fuel to renewables, because the more of a more people that are doing that, the more it will happen. So that's continue educating people, keep them involved by doing small things, and then really concentrate on how we can switch to a renewable future.
Becky Meyer, you talked about NIMBY, that idea of not in my backyard, and how that was the motivation for a lot of people. Can you draw that out a little bit? What did that mean for people getting involved or not getting involved? And how did that affect you directly because you got involved?
Well, I think most of the people who were initially involved, the pipeline was actually going to come either on their property, through their property, or close to their property. So they were scared of what it would do to their property values, what it might do to their health and safety, and how particularly we were going to have a compressor station in Rensselaer County. And so the people around there were, you know, much more concerned even than the pipeline. And and we had done meetings about the health effects of the compressor station and the possibilities of leaks and explosions. I mean, the number of people who just said there is such a relief, they feel they can stay in their home. Some people were thinking about leaving their homes, but worried about resale value even if they did. And just an incredible sense of personal relief for their everyday life. Sometimes people try to move the pipeline away from their community, and we kept saying, you know, that's not our focus, because then we're just going to make some other group of people as miserable as you are now. We really have to fight against the need and the necessity for a pipeline rather than just move it from one place to another. And I think people really began to understand that rally cry. And I think the number of people who have talked about wanting to continue this fight is very impressive. So even though their home is now not in jeopardy, they still feel some responsibility to the larger community.
Do you think that people need to up the ante and take bolder action around climate change?
Toward the end of this fight, I was inching into, I think we need to start talking about some nonviolent civil disobedience, and could we get somebody to come out and give us some training, and could we inch into that direction? So we weren't there, and even myself, I'm somewhat cautious and concerned. You know, we had a veterinarian who said, you know, I can't, if I'm ever arrested, I will lose my license. So, you know, there were lots of legitimate concerns. I'm very glad that there are people doing that. Whether or not it's something that I personally am either comfortable with or feel is the best way, I think it's really important, and I think it's uncomfortable, and there is definitely backlash that you need to deal with, but I do believe that most of the real changes that have happened in our country often have needed that level of involvement.
That was Becky Meyer of the group Stop the New York Frack Gas Pipeline. Find links to groups opposing gas pipeline projects and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There's no doubt that we're living in a time where there's enormous discontent, if not anger, about the failure of both our political and economic systems here in the U.S. Millions of working people across the country have seen their standard of living steadily decline. And what's worse, parents see a future where their children will likely have less economic opportunity and security than they did. In short, what we're seeing is the bubble bursting on the so-called American dream and the erosion of the middle class. This year's presidential election campaign, with both the unexpected victory of Donald Trump among GOP voters responding to appeals to racism and xenophobia, and the unforeseen enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders' progressive campaign reflect the crumbling edifice of the major two-party duopoly. Many Americans, who see the current political system as corrupt and working against their interests, are now eager to support outsiders to shake up the status quo. In addition to the brief jolt of energy and consciousness raised by the Occupy Wall Street movement here in the U.S. in 2011, uprisings against economic conditions have been cropping up across the world in recent years. While new left movements have organized in Spain, France, Italy, and Portugal, the anti-immigrant right has also gained support, mainly in response to rising Islamophobia and a flood of refugees arriving from Syria and other conflict zones. Tariq Ali, a British writer and filmmaker who has written more than 24 books on world history and politics, recently spoke at New York City's annual Left Forum conference, where he addressed the topic of capitalism and militarism at humanity's peril organizing our power. Here we present an excerpt of Ali's talk, where he focused on the growing worldwide movement resisting economic inequality and austerity policies.
Very glad to be here, especially at this time, because though we're talking about the presidential candidates, Senator Clinton and Donald Trump, what has really been exciting, watching what is going on from afar in the United States, has been these huge mobilizations of young people in favor of a candidate who talks of socialism. We can now, and what I want to tell you is that this movement of young people, which has brought many more people together than one could have imagined, much larger than any political campaign I remember, involving trying to go for it against the mainstream, than at any other time in recent American history. The Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War movement didn't create a political side to it, even though Martin Luther King was talking of running as an alternative president, not inside the Democratic Party, but together with Dr. Spock challenging the Democratic Party. That didn't happen. One reason it didn't happen is he was killed. So what we are witnessing is a very interesting radicalization, and it's a radicalization of young people which is happening in most countries in Europe today. Why? Since the 2008 Wall Street crash, many people felt, especially those who had absolutely no idea or no alternative view, that somehow the governors of the world, the rulers of this world, capitalist world, would manage to put something new in place that would give some comfort to the poor and to the young, who suffer even more on many levels. Lack of housing, too much to pay for education, and increasingly in some parts of Europe, health as well. Though we have national health services, they are under very heavy fire and attack from American health corporations, who are increasingly being given contracts by state-owned health services as part of the neoliberal system. So in this situation, it was felt that if the elites who rule the world were a bit more rational, they would attempt to put in place something different, something that had been tried before. It didn't happen. And after a short wait, you had the emergence of new popular movements from the left, and you had the emergence of mass movements from the right. This process began in different ways in different countries, but we can now see a pattern, as we can see in the United States too. And this pattern is as follows. All these movements had one thing in common. They developed from the grassroots. They developed often in one part of the country, either a region, Sicily in the case of the Five Star Movement, Madrid in the case of the occupation of the squares in Spain, and then spread rapidly from there to the rest of the country. We've been witnessing now, even as I speak, the rise of a new popular movement in France, again a movement which pushes all the established political parties to one side and says, we don't trust you. Or the intellectuals who serve these parties, we don't trust you. Keep away, move away. And we want to unite with trade unions to fight against the new laws that the French socialist government, so-called, is bringing and putting onto the statute book to restrict labor rights in France. And this movement comes together at night. Some of them work during the day. Others think it's a nice time to do it, to occupy the night, la nuit debout, the night rising. And they meet. And increasingly, this movement, which started in Paris, is spreading and has spread to other parts of France. There have been clashes with the riot police, etc., etc. We live in a very strange world, a world of transition in which the system that is in place is not working. Everyone knows it's not working. We know it's not working, and those who run the system know it's not working. Because were it working even a tiny bit, then all these jokers in Wall Street, the bankers who stole money, half of them would be in prison for what they did.
That was an excerpt of a talk by Tariq Ali, a British writer and filmmaker, speaking at the annual Leftform Conference in New York City on May 20th. Find links to related articles and additional recordings from the Leftform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.